Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, the Hakalmana El Bay. And this evening, we're going to be dealing with handling contracts and redeeming your straw man. We're going to deal with the actual inside and outs of these contracts. And we have some very interesting information on your straw man and the redemption process involving that. And keep in mind, we're going to try to do this as part one, but we may come back and do part two on it. Now, we're offering our free articles this evening in the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play. Also, Secrets of America, where you get that, just send me an email. Say, Tahaga, send me those free articles. I get them right on to you, 2TARHAKA53@hotmail.com. That's the Tahaga53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that on to you, okay? Don't forget, the solution to what we're about to discuss this evening and how to get it done with the quickness is right there at newfreehelpgroup.com. That's newfreehelpgroup.com. We got that in the chat room. And don't hesitate to raise your hands this evening if you got any questions. And we'll see if we can try to get to you as quickly as possible. Now, as far as your social sites is concerned, if you're on Facebook or Twitter or MySpace or Black Planet, or regardless of where you are, send me a friend request. Send that to Tahaka Amana El Bay. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A, Amana A-M-A-A-N-A, El Bay, E-L, and then B-E-Y. And that'll give you access to Mawal. We get become connected to one another, and we can network together, okay? Now, dealing with these contracts, in dealing with them, we want to deal with the following. What is the construction of these contracts? How does offer and acceptance work in contracts? What is the mechanics behind redemption of a straw man? And this is what we're going to try to deal with here this evening. But before we get started, y'all hold your hat a minute. We'll be right back. Okay?
Greetings. I'd like to invite you out to the Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th, 2013, located in Jacksonville, Florida. 3 days of executing and planning of executive plans for 25-year agenda, operating as an economic unit. The presenters will be Shem L. of the Tamarain 2 Project, Dr. Ali Muhammad and Minister Inki of the Black Genetic Tour, Sundiata Amael, Professor Isef Deanham L., Tahaka Amana L., Abundance Child, Fatima, the Alchemist Shabazz, Messiah L., and more. Topics will be the execution of urban geoponics, creating independent distribution systems, creating independent economic systems, genetics, private security force, the wholesale and manufacturing of natural products, Morristown, creating one in every state, Morris Eastside Farms, putting one in every state. You do not want to miss this summit. It is very enlightening, empowering, and most of all, it's applicable. Everything that we talk about, we do. Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th. Log on to www.summitofthemoors.com. You can register for free. The summit is always free. You can also get your hotel room, which will be on the river at the Wyndham Hotel. That's www.summitofthemoors.com. The summits are always free. See you at the summit.
Okay, Moors, we got a new website up. It's newfreehelpgroup.com. Now, when you go over to newfreehelpgroup.com, make sure you examine everything that's there. We put several packages up for those people who are having, if you're in your house upside down and you just want to cancel your mortgage outright. It's all illegal anyway. Just go right over there to newfreehelpgroup.com, and the link of talkarchives.org is there. Just click on that. You will see all the packages that's made available to you. Now, don't forget, you cancel your debt, you got a student loan debt, child support debt, credit card debt, all that can be dealt with. And any other contract cancellations, you'll see all the packages that's there made available. But what we are doing is, for anybody that's accessing these packages all the way up until July, we're adding to our archives to each one. So don't forget, go right there to newfreehelpgroup.com and click on the link at talkarchives.org, and everything is sitting right there waiting on you. Okay? Peace, Moses.
Okay, Moses. Now, dealing with your contracts, and we have to keep in mind that anytime you're buying a home, there's contracts involved. When you are being told that you owe child support, there are contracts involved. Student loans, contracts, credit cards, contracts, everything that you deal with in contracts. So what we want to do here today is we want to take a look inside of this thing. We want to crack that nut open, and let's dig around in there so that we can learn how to formulate these contracts or how to cancel contracts that we have that's not in our favor, that's not benefiting us. And nine times out of ten, whoever it is that create the contract is the one that's profiting from the contract. And all too often, you're the one that's doing all the paying. So we want to turn this around the other way so we can make it go the other way. Okay. Now, the first thing we're going to deal with is offer and then acceptance. What's an offer? What's an acceptance? Let's get the basic structure of this contract situation understood, and then we can go to the next part. We'll deal with offer first, and then we'll come back with some acceptance. And we'll run a little quick plug here, so pay attention. I hope you got your paper and pen handy. I should have put that in the advertisement, but I didn't do it this evening.
Welcome to Law Sessions. I am Jennifer Houlton. In this session, I will introduce you to 1, the basic concept of what a contract is, and 2, an introduction to contract formation. In particular, we will focus on the principles of offer and invitation to treat. Now, offer and acceptance together is termed agreement, but our focus in this lecture will be an introduction to contract and the concept of offer, and then contrasting it to the principle of invitation to treat. Now first, starting with the basic concept of what a contract is, the layperson would of course say that it is an agreement between 2 or more persons, but that is what will distinguish you the budding lawyer, from the layperson, because throughout this series, you will hear me tell you to go to source. Now, in studying this or any other topic, never ever rely solely on what a tutor says, or a lecturer says, or God forbid, what a fellow student says, or even what I may say to you. Check for yourself from source, which for you as the law student, of course, means the experts. And by the experts, I mean the academics and the court decisions. Yes, you must read the cases. And if legislation is involved, what a particular act says. Now, it means that whatever we discuss here, we will go to source. Now then, what is a suitable definition of a contract? Well, if we were to go to the source for the answer, the first response, in my view, is from Professor Treitel, who says that a contract is an agreement giving rise to obligations which are enforced or recognized by law. Now, he carries on by saying that the factor which distinguishes contractual from other legal obligations, for example, tort, is that they are based on the agreement of the contracting parties. Now, Sir Frederick Pollock, for his part, says that a contract is a promise or a set of promises which the law will enforce. And of course, not to be outdone, we see Sir William Anson saying that the law of contract may be provisionally described as that branch of the law which determines the circumstances in which a promise shall be legally binding on the person making it. So as a starting point, therefore, we can see that the great minds of contract law are united, not least that in the law of contract, not all agreements will be an agreement that is enforceable in law. So if we are dealing with a social arrangement, for example, say I ask my son to wash my car, or if we are dealing with an illegal agreement, so you and I agree that you will use my spare bedroom for the purposes of prostitution, or if we are dealing with an agreement that is contrary to public policy, so making an agreement which the law disapproves of, then such agreements, unfortunately, as much as I would like the income from the proceeds of the spare bedroom, will not be enforceable. It is the enforceability requirement which is significant in determining what is a contract. Now, the three essential elements of a valid contract under English law are agreement, meaning offer and acceptance, intention to create legal relations, and of course, consideration. Now, by the end of this session, we will have reviewed the contract element of agreement, which is usually expressed in terms of offer and acceptance. It is that meeting of the minds of those two parties, the consensus ad idem, that meeting of the offer with the corresponding acceptance that constitutes the agreement. So our objective over this session are to know what is an offer and to be able to distinguish an offer from other forms of communication. In particular, what is an invitation to treat? So we will know what is the correlation between offer and possibly acceptance, and then what is meant by an offer. And of course, consider it in the context of invitation to treat. Well, an offer could be defined as a proposal or a promise by one person, who is called the offeror in law, to enter into a contract on a particular set of terms with the specific intention of being bound by that promise as soon as the person to whom the promise is made, called the offeree, signifies his acceptance. Now, that may sound a fairly long definition, so let's put it another way. It is where, from an objective standpoint, there is an expression of willingness by the offeror to be bound by its terms once it is accepted by the offeree. Now then, an offer may be made to an individual. It may be made to a group. It may be made to the general public. So, for example, a reward for information or a reward for finding and returning a dog. An offer may be written. It may be spoken. It may be implied by conduct. Now, one important point for law students to remember is that what in fact amounts to an offer can and certainly does give rise to differences of opinion. So, for example, during the bargaining process, there may be a series of communications between the offeror on the one hand and the offeree on the other as they move towards a final agreement. And so it may be difficult to be exactly sure whether a specific statement was an offer or whether it was only part of continuing negotiations between the parties. It is these that you have to be careful of, because examiners tend to seize on and exploit these when they are writing contract law questions. They want you to discuss the fine line distinctions by using the cases and going to source for academic commentary in determining if a particular communication is an offer or not. Now, one possible approach in determining whether there is an offer is to examine whether they were expected to bargain further. Were the parties expected to bargain further? Or whether the communications made to that point showed a clear willingness to be bound if the other party agreed or assented. Now, this is easier said than done, as the cases conflict at times. In fact, to understand the principle of offer, any discussion must consider the two contrasting cases of Stora and Manchester City Council in 1974 and Gibson and Manchester City Council in 1979. Now, both cases were concerned with Manchester City Council's policy of selling off council houses to its tenants who were living in them. Now, councils in England tend to be the largest social landlords, and in a particular area and at any time, Manchester City Council was controlled by the Conservative Party, and this was an era when there was a Conservative Party policy to make homeowners of their council tenants. So basically, persons who had been renting their properties now had the right to buy them. And this was considered the right to buy scheme, making people owners of their own property. Now, Mr. Stora and Mr. Gibson were two such tenants who wanted to buy their council house. However, control of Manchester City Council passed to the Labour Party, who of course took a more paternalistic view of selling off housing stock of the council. And they resolved to discontinue the sale of council houses. And what we will discuss next is how the council's communication to each of the two gentlemen was viewed by the court and the determination by the courts of the status of each communication. By way of recap, therefore, Tritol, Pollock, and Anson say that a contract is a legally enforceable agreement. The requirements of a contract are agreement, meaning offer and acceptance, intention to create legal relations, and consideration. An offer is an expression of willingness by the offeror to be bound once there is acceptance by the offeree. We will then go into part two, of course, and we will continue with offer as well as the two cases raised earlier. And in that segment, we will look at the contrasting cases of Stora and Gibson and further consider the situations where an offer is shown as being distinct from an invitation to treat. Welcome to Law Sessions. I am Jennifer Housen. In this law session, we will consider acceptance, and we will also consider certainty of terms and the intention to create legal relations, all in this session. In the previous lecture, I looked at offer, and I also drew a distinction between an offer and an invitation to treat, and just by way of background, what contract law is. So this lecture is somewhat of a continuation to that. Now, once you have an offer that has been accepted, a binding contract is made, and of course, that ends the offer. So acceptance together with the offer amounts to an agreement. Now, TRICLE defines acceptance as a final, unqualified expression of assent to all of the terms of an offer. Now, acceptance is subject to an objective test, which is very similar to offers, which also require an objective test. So it similarly here apply in the same manner. So in other words, evidence must be produced from which the courts can adduce that an intention by the offeree to accept the offer communicated to them, you must show that in the context of an offer and acceptance situation. Now, two principles which evolve from the definition of acceptance and the requirements of this objective existence are, first of all, the expression of an intention to assent to the offer must be there, as seen in the case of Taylor and Leard, and it must be in response to the offer, and it must match the terms of the offer precisely. Now, the acceptance must be unequivocal and unconditional, because if it is an equivocal acceptance, or if the response is equivocal, or if there is a condition attached, as we will see later, that will not amount to an acceptance. Rather, it may very well have the effect of either getting rid of the offer or just having no effect at all on the offer. The second, of course, is that simply acknowledging the offer is not enough. There must be a communication of the acceptance to the offeror. Now, a counteroffer amounts to a rejection of the original offer, and this is what I was alluding to earlier. So in Hyde and Wrench, the defendant had made a written offer to sell his farm to the plaintiff for £1,000. Now, this is back in 1840. Now, the plaintiff replied that he would give him £950 for it. Now, the defendant refused to sell at the lower price, and a few days later, the plaintiff wrote to him saying, well, I'm agreeing now. So the defendant wrote to the plaintiff wrote to the defendant agreeing to pay £1,000 for the property. By that time, of course, the defendant had decided he didn't want to sell anymore, so he withdrew his original offer. He refuses to sell to the plaintiff, and the court said that there was no contract. The plaintiff's counteroffer of £950 was a rejection of the defendant's original offer and brought it to an end. It could not be revived afterwards by the plaintiff simply purporting to accept it. How this translates on an exam generally, of course, is that the examiner will say something like, X is selling his computer, and X tells Y that he's selling the computer for £1,000. The examiner will then, of course, put in a sort of chain of events which show that Y, for example, responded to X and said something along the lines of, I've got £950. But you have to watch exactly the words used in the exams. Now, one of the important things, as I've mentioned before in the previous lecture, is that it is for you to determine what the status of each communication is. Never leave it to the examiner to tell you what it is. So the examiner might say, X is selling his computer for £1,000. Paul accepted and said that he will give him £950. Well, that isn't an acceptance because that's not what it was being sold for. So what you need to do is look at what it is and then, of course, explain it to the extent that what we see from the offeree is potentially a counteroffer. It may very well, as later on when we come to it, it may very well be that the offeree writes back and says to X, would you be willing to accept two post-dated checks? Well, it will be for you to discuss whether that is a counteroffer or, as we'll see later, if it could be of some other type of status. Now then, there are situations where the offeree does not put forward a new proposal, but merely seeks clarification of the offer, or he seeks further information about it from the offeror. In such a case, the offer is not to be regarded as rejected, and it is still open for the offeree to accept it. Now, this, of course, can be seen in the case of Stevenson and McLean. And the idea is that Stevenson and McLean stand for the proposition that if it is that the offeree is simply asking a question, then this will not have the hide and wrench effect of killing off the original offer. So what you need to do is to look at what the examiner has said to you and determine, is it an acceptance or is it a counteroffer? If it is that it is is it an acceptance based on the fact that he is simply requesting information, then it will not amount to a counteroffer. So if the examiner were to give you a scenario whereby he says that X offers his computer to Y for £1,000, Y wrote back saying, I would not be able to buy it unless I am able to pay for it 3 months from now. You have to watch that very carefully, because if he's saying he wouldn't be able to buy it otherwise, that may very well be a counteroffer. But if he said, would you be willing to accept two payments, that may be a Stevenson and McLean situation, because he's not suggesting that he can't buy it. He's asking, maybe looking for a good deal in terms of keeping his money, is whether or not he may consider two payments. But what you need to do is to discuss it, and then you need to make submissions. Remember that in law there is no right.
Okay, Moore, we're back. Now, if there's any of you who do not understand the offer and acceptance in your contracts, you raise your hand, and we can work with that. But I'm going to give you some examples of how that works. We'll say that a person is, we're sitting on food stamps. But they get a letter from the food stamp office and say, well, we have determined that you were ineligible for receiving food stamps. And you, however, you have received food stamps from January to October. And we're afraid that you're going to have to return the money back to our office, or we would seek further action. And we can arrange payments for you to pay the money back, and so on and so forth. So what we have here is an offer. It may seem somewhat threatening, but there's an offer, and the fact that they are saying that we could sit down with you and arrange some type of payment back to us, and this is an offer, and then we have consideration inside the offer because they're offering to help you pay the money back. Now, you may feel like, okay, well, all the information I gave you all was valuable, accurate, and there must be a mistake on your end. So now we come to discussion before formulating a contract that both parties can agree to work on and settle a matter. The best thing to try to do is settle a matter out of court. And you do that through contracts in the form of affidavits to one another. If you've received a letter like that, you want to make sure that you respond immediately to that offer And if you are not in agreement with what they're saying, then you can enter a counter offer and explain your position and see where you all can go from there. And that's how it works. And that's the best way to deal with the situation instead of just ignoring the situation, especially if they send you this letter in the form of an affidavit or something, which means that if you do not respond to that the offer in that that's been sent to you, then that means that the information is all true through your non-response or what's called acquiescence. And we want to be very, very careful, just like the young lady said. We want to read and understand the words in all contracts that's presented to us at all times. You want to read them thoroughly so that you can understand exactly what offers are being made, how the words are set up on that contract, and how it puts you in a position to respond successfully with the acceptance of the offer or with a counter offer, which makes the first offer void. If you're in a counter offer and you're putting them in a position where they'll have to respond to your offer. Okay? So that's the way that works in offer and acceptance inside of contracts. That's one of the best examples that I could find in a clear breakdown on offer acceptance and contracts. But now, what we want to do now is I want to move over to the next segment where we are dealing with the straw man and getting to the bottom of how that plays inside of the United States system of contracts. And however, before we do, y'all hold on for 1 second, and we will be right
okay,
back.
Okay, Morris, the most powerful system for total elimination of your mortgage on the globe. It stands to reason that if the United States filed bankruptcy in 1933, taking all the real money out of circulation, that our signatures on contracts and stuff is the only thing that's left. Now, we have a system that's set up to totally get rid of that mortgage contract. And if you got student loan debt, if you got your child support, whatever, then we got all contract eliminator as well. And what we're doing here now for those people who are accessing either one of these new packages that's located at newfreehelpgroup.com, we are adding Talkers Archives to it absolutely at no charge to you. So get over to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Okay? Peace, Mose.
Well, thank you for joining us. This is kind of an informal discussion on redeeming the straw man. My name is Kent Hovind. With me is John D'Arcy from South Florida. Thank you, John. Nice of you to drive all the way up to visit us here in Pensacola. America's in trouble. We have a lot of people confused about what's going on. This will be just kind of an informal discussion about a variety. It ties on a variety of topics, but where are our rights? Our founding fathers said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, rights that you just can't put a lien against." And what we want to try to do is just explain where we lost it and how to get it back. Just try to keep it simple so folks like me can understand it. Basically, God created the universe. We've got a little chart here behind me that kind of explains God created people. This would be Kent Hovind, John D'Arcy, you know, John Doe, etc., etc. We the people got together 200 years ago and created a state government. All of those states got together and created a federal government. And the federal government is supposed to be the servant to the state government. States are supposed to be supreme, states' rights, which goes into a long story of the wrong side winning the Civil War, right?
Exactly. What was the Civil War?
What was the Civil War? It's Abe Lincoln's war. It wasn't the Civil War.
That's right. It wasn't slavery.
It wasn't slavery, no. And then the federal government created a corporate federal government. Notice it's all capital letters. The corporate federal government created a corporate state government. And one of these two, somewhere in here, created persons with all capital letters. This would be Kent Hovind with all capital letters. This is not me. Which leaves us with an interesting situation. Since whatever God creates, he controls, and we're supposed to be subservient to God, whatever we create, we control, and the states, the federal and state government are supposed to be subservient to we the people. They're supposed to be our servant. But whatever the government creates, it controls. So the government has created persons, actually a corporate soul, for every individual being in the United States. There's a corporate Kent Hovind and a corporate John D'Arcy. And they can pass all sorts of rules and regulations for their corporation, which they own and control and regulate, etc. Now, they're using my name, though. They created a corporation and chose my name to go on there and chose your name to go on one and everybody else's name to go on one. So they've kind of abused their privilege and stepped out of their delegated authority and used my name. So that leaves me with four choices to take. Number one, I can do what they say, which is what most Americans do. The state government can tell their person, you must wear a seatbelt when you drive your car. They can tell this person, you must file an income tax form. You must get a Social Security number. You must get a driver's license. You must get a birth certificate, et cetera, et cetera. And they have the right to tell that to this person. So I can either say, okay, I'll do what you say. I can bring myself from here all the way down and submit myself under these corporations. Or I can try to cut the string between this we the people, and the artificial we the people. I try to cut that string, and some people do that with varying degrees of success. Number three, I can look for loopholes in the laws and say, well, wait a minute, this law doesn't require that I do this. And some people with varying degrees of success look for loopholes and say, wait a minute, the state does not require persons to file a tax form unless they are a drug dealer from the Virgin Islands or live in Washington, D.C., or use a zip code, and all sorts of different arguments have been used, and some not too successful. Choice number four is claim this guy. Say, hey, you're using my name. That's mine. I want it. That's what I want John to explain to us today. How do we redeem that straw man, and what does that mean, redeeming that straw man and moving him or claiming him as your own? John, tell us about that.
Well, redemption is basically very biblically grounded.
Oh, yes, right.
And it is the soul of the Christian's belief that we ultimately, our souls are redeemed through Jesus Christ. And all we have to do is accept his finished work on the cross, and we are eternally redeemed. And Christ then protects and holds our soul for all eternity. So it's very biblically based. And it's funny that no matter how corrupt things seem to be getting, government seems to follow God's law.
Mm-hmm.
You ever wonder why every 7 years you can file a bankruptcy and not 12? Or
yeah,
every
why,
three?
Why seven? Just, yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, the Bible talks about things like that in year of Jubilee and things like that. And there's another principle about giving your fellow man notice and grace. And a lot of people might say, well, why? How can you call that just for a God to take a heathen in Africa who never saw the Bible and expect him to have knowledge of Jesus Christ? And Isaiah talks about how God has given everyone notice. Then shall it be for a man to burn, for he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it and breaketh bread. Yea, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. He maketh it a graven image and falleth down thereto. So we see one type of man that looks at God's nature and he does not marvel at it, but he has rejected God's general revelation as opposed to objective, in stark contradiction with what David does.
Yeah, David looked at himself and said, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, in the book of Psalms, you know. And as a biology teacher, I would agree, you know, all you got to do is study anything about human anatomy or biology, and you'll say, man, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. One cell more complex than a space shuttle.
Amen.
It's unbelievable. You know, the best thing man can build is, you know, God built trillions and trillions of them, you know.
Yeah. So we got the two type of people there. And so man is not without excuse that God has testified to man. And if man accepts God's general revelation, then God is faithful and he will send him specific revelation, meaning the Bible and knowledge of Jesus Christ. So the heathen that's out in the middle of the jungles in Africa who does not have a Bible, he will be held accountable to the revelation and knowledge he has, meaning nature. So that is a very basic principle of law that we have to give notice and grace. And just as God gives us notice and grace, in law, would anybody be surprised to find out that there are very elements of notice and grace that are given? And that is a very, what I consider to be a biblical principle that is very prominent in this whole concept of redeeming the straw man.
Wait a minute, so you're saying it's in God's economy or God's plan or God's character, give notice of what you expect.
That's right.
And what you want.
That's right.
And then the grace is a time period in which to accomplish this?
That's right.
Okay.
Okay. And the other concept that I see here is we've got a mirror, okay? And we have God, and he's perfect, he's holy, he's just. And the flip side to that would be Satan. And he is the exact opposite of what is holy and what is just. Right? He's evil. And God, only God, can create real, tangible things. You know, paper,
sure,
wood,
matter, time,
and,
right.
And so Satan cannot. So all he is left doing is counterfeiting. And he's a great counterfeiter. And that is the other principle that we find out here in the straw man, is that whatever God created, Satan's got his counterfeit to. And man turns around, and man created real de jure government. The government turned around and created a fiction. And I like to think of the state, in fact, when we start talking about government, when I mention the word state, I think of the state that is created in the womb, mankind.
Okay.
That is real government. And our founding fathers said, there is where the basis of all government, you know, it's held within mankind.
Right.
The executive, legislative, and judicial.
Even in Genesis chapter 10, after the flood, God told Noah, he established government. He said, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed.
That's a great point.
Right.
And we have our dispensational theology, and we have...
Okay, Morris. Now, the reason I use that is because it clearly describes where they got the little system that they use here in the United States. And of course, we know that the original records, what they're calling the Bible, original records, are ancient African records, and so therefore it came from you. So that's where they're deriving this stuff from. So you can go back, and because there's also remedies in there for all that they have taken and twisted, and to be able to use this stuff to your benefit, okay? I just want to make sure that we get an understanding of where it came from so now we can continue to do
theology. And a lot of times I meet people who want to throw away covenant theology and say we're under dispensational theology, and then other people that want to say there's no dispensations and they're all covenant theology. And the other point that I think is important is we can't sit here and say, well, we're under grace, let's throw law out, because very clearly law does apply in our life. If you don't believe so, go jump off a 10-story building, you'll find out how quickly law applies.
The law of gravity is applying all the constantly, right?
A circle has 360 degrees.
Whether you like it or not.
Exactly.
Sure.
So, but law does not affect our justification, okay? But if we keep certain laws, we might live a lot longer and be healthier.
Right.
Okay? And so we are not justified by keeping that law. But that's why I say, although a lot of these concepts in the straw man are there in the law, Old Testament, they still apply because we have not ultimately become totally sanctified yet.
Mm-hmm.
Someday when we reach total sanctification, none of this will be relevant as opposed to the law, and we will have new bodies. We won't be able to sin and things like that. So I guess that's the basis for redeeming the straw man.
Well, tell me, you mentioned an illustration that seems to make a lot of sense about McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that about McDonald's.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Okay, if we were to go out today and just start building a McDonald's franchise, but we never paid our license fees and we never told McDonald's about it, we just figured they got millions of stores, they'll never know. We could probably get away with that and keep going and sticking the money in our pocket. Now, most Christians I know would probably say, "Ooh, John, that's very unethical," right? But as long as we didn't get caught, we could get away with it, okay? In essence, that's what's happened to us. They have created a straw man, and they are using this entity. And as long as we don't show up to say, "Hey, you can't do that," they're going to go keep on using that.
Okay, so since they created this and used your name...
That's right.
If as long as you don't say anything, well...
They keep
using it, sure.
And it gets worse than that, because we take ourselves out of a position where we are accountable to God, and we come on down and we say, "We will become that person for you." And we take ourselves out of a position of being their master and put ourselves in a position of
being
becoming
the servant.
The servant.
Have churches done the same thing by becoming incorporated?
That's a very interesting issue.
This will
the 501c3 corporation. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case named Hale v. Hinkle. And in that court case, they basically stated that a corporation is a creature of the state.
Okay.
All right. Let's follow this analogy through with an illustration. Let's take your phone number, for instance.
Okay.
Who owns that phone number?
Good question. I guess I have to pay every month for it, so the company owns it.
So the
I'm
phone
renting.
Company, basically.
Yeah.
If we stop meeting our contractual obligations, mainly, paying our phone bill...
They'll take it away and give it to somebody else.
Exactly.
Sure, right.
And you'll see how long that phone number is yours.
30 days.
All right? So the same thing with a corporation. A corporation is a creature of the state. Okay? You have to apply to the state. Okay? You fill out all these articles in the corporation, and it has to be follow the guidelines that the state sets. Right? Once they get these articles of incorporation and you pay a fee to the state, they will stamp that thing in and you become a corporation. Right? But they've got some, just like that phone bill, they've got some guidelines you got to follow. Well, you got to file this tax return every year. You got to file your minutes. You've got to pay a fee every year to use that corporation. And if you don't pay your fee every year, you can't even defend a lawsuit that comes along. So a corporation is the creature of a state, and it does not exist as a matter of right. See, God never created corporations, but it is down in this world existing as an entity of privilege. And who ultimately owns that corporation? Well, the state.
Whoever created it.
The state.
The state created it, so they own it.
If it's Utah or California or Florida. And the stockholders basically have a beneficial interest in the use of that corporation. Very interesting. So a 501c3 is nothing more than another type of corporation. The state owns it. So now, when they come in, and I believe, Kent, that this is just around the corner, and a lot of churches are going to get really caught off guard by this, but I think they're going to be in very shortly saying, well, you have to have, if your church has 3,000 members, you're going to have an equal pro rata share of queer ministers on staff.
Sure.
And if you don't have a queer minister, they could revoke that tax status. And you want to say, well, man, isn't that unconstitutional?
No, not really. They created it.
Yep, and it's just like that scenario with McDonald's. Okay, if you want to sell Grandma Hovine's 1-pound hamburgers, you can do that. But once you enter into a franchise agreement with McDonald's, you can't sell Grandma Holbein's.
You have to sell what they tell me to sell.
You have to, exactly. So if we have left our position with God and we have elected to become this corporate franchise, and they say you will have queer ministers, at that point in time, I think it, as Christians, it becomes a matter of, are we going to honor our contracts?
Yes.
So I think it's more important to watch what we're doing and be careful the contracts we get into if we don't want to have to follow the terms of those contracts later.
Well, see, in Proverbs chapter 6, it says, if you've stricken your hand with a stranger, you know, you made a contract,
mm-hmm.
try to get out of it. Do your best to undo that,
right.
especially an unending contract. If I say, John, I'm going to hire you for $10 an hour to work for me, well, I probably should have an end to that, you know, to work for me until this project is completed, and in case it's taking longer than I thought, then we have a cutoff deadline of, you know. Unending contracts are dangerous, you know, you've got to be very cautious about that, and Proverbs chapter 6 warns us about that. So I get some flack from other Christians because we have not incorporated. I am not 501c3. I don't want to take, God told me to go preach his word, okay?
Right.
I don't need the state's permission to do what God already told me to do. And people who have taken the state's permission look at me like I'm some kind of odd duck, like why aren't you incorporated and why haven't you jumped through all these hoops? Well, John Bunyan spent years in jail over this very issue. He refused to take a state license to preach.
Right.
The government said, you must get a license to preach. He said, I'm sorry. If I do that, that's putting God under you guys. I can't put God under you.
Amen.
And so I don't understand why some Christians get bent out of shape with me about that. I'm trying to do what God told me to do.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing. We got these little citizens' rule books here. And in this rule book, there's a story, you know, give me liberty, give me death, about Patrick Henry. Was shocked, and he served on a jury here in this country around 1775 where they were wanting a man to take a license to preach. And he was a juror, and he says, no way, you can't do that. And they wound up throwing him in jail as a juror until they weren't going to let him out until he agreed to find the guy guilty. And he was willing to stay there in jail and lose his business. A lot of Christians might say, well, what kind of a testimony is that? He wound up in jail. But still, he did the right thing.
Right.
And finally, he was covered in his own thesis. They finally let him out because he wouldn't find the guy guilty. I'm going to die here. He's not guilty. And that's another sad truth is that the judges are telling everybody when you serve on a jury that it has to be unanimous one way or another. And the truth is, if one juror says the guy's not guilty, there's your reasonable doubt.
That's exactly correct.
Okay, one juror says no.
And a juror can do that if he thinks the law is unjust.
That's right.
It doesn't matter. Okay, if that's the law, you can't spit on the sidewalk. Somebody spits on the sidewalk. He goes to court. You know, gets tried. It's obvious.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, if any of you have any questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand, and we can discuss this thing. Here we have a system that just like we have the Pope in Rome that have put themselves in between you and your creator and says that, well, we are his agents on earth and we are the go-between between you and your creator. But I don't need a go-between. I don't need a go-between, and I don't know about you. As far as the people being thrown in jail and all that stuff, I find it difficult to understand. Now, if I have a birth certificate at birth where you clearly have regarded me as your property on contract, and you got this birth contract, and but it, you know, I never signed it. Someone else signed it on my behalf, which was my parents or what have you. But then once I become a certain age, I'm the only one that can handle that contract. So therefore, what if I went and canceled that contract? And what if I went and canceled that Social Security number and made sure that all of this stuff was canceled? It would be pretty interesting to see how you would continue to regard me as your property when your contract has been canceled and a new contract has been issued. You're not a corporation. I mean, you are not
a country, but you are a corporation, and but you don't have no contract with a corporate entity to regard as your property. So it's very, very interesting. And information on this is right there in Tahaka's archives, as well as getting the actual contracts themselves to do exactly what I just mentioned is right there at newfreehelpgroup.com. And I wanted to put this information out because there are remedies. And see, what is happening is these people have regarded the masses inside the United States as their property. And they have used these contracts to make money off, and we have done nothing about the contract. We haven't canceled the contract. We haven't even, a lot of us haven't even studied anything about the contract. A lot of us don't even know anything about the existence of these contracts. But it is very important to understand if someone has borrowed money and used you as collateral, I think it's very important for you to understand what's going on, you see. And this is what has happened inside the United States. It filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You know, they sold out, and you being held liable for their debt and their mistakes and their fraud and their conspiracies and corruptions. So looking at dealing with these contracts is very important. And it's something we need to pay close attention to and try to do something about these things. Okay?
Broke the law. But is the law reasonable? And
that's
if
right.
The juror says, no, that law is not reasonable,
Throw it out.
The juror simply votes not guilty. Even though it's obvious he's guilty for breaking the law, the juror's vote of not guilty because the law is unjust is all that's necessary. And
that's right.
Jurors only knew that.
Exactly. You guys sell these here, and this is just a great book.
Yeah, like a dollar or something. You
yeah,
know, give one to everybody you know.
You know, I really think people, would, you know, they call them, they order some tapes from me. They really need to, you know, order three or four of these because you need to get them out and give them to your children and things like that. And it's an awesome book.
These have been given out all over Santa Rosa County, which is the next county over from us.
Mm-hmm.
And their court system is really having a good time because of this, because the jurors know they're right. You know, they're having,
awesome.
Having an informed jury is just really helpful. So, okay. Back to the McDonald's issue. I started McDonald's. I'm making a bunch of money. Things are going fine. But you own the real McDonald's.
That's right.
You are Mr. What's his name? Kroc?
Mr. Ray Kroc.
Mr. Ray Kroc. Okay. So you come to me and say, hey, Kent Hovind, sorry, you can't use my name anymore.
That's right. Now you've got problems.
Right.
But until the real McDonald's Corporation showed up and is saying you can't use our name, you've been making a lot of money. Things have been working good for you.
Sure.
And that's a scenario that's been going on right now.
The government's using our name.
That's right. And they're making all these laws and regulations for this guy. You got to pay all kinds of taxes. You got to get a license for a church. You got to get a license to blow your nose and a license to have children and a license to death. And the truth is they can't make people have a license to have children and things like that.
I hate to keep interrupting you here, but I want to understand this, okay? My son, when he got married, elected not to get a marriage license.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need state's permission to do something God said you can do. God ordained
right.
marriage, okay?
Right.
And I get some Christians even today that still don't understand, you know, that they think I'm some kind of radical. I guess it's because everybody's been doing this for so long.
Yeah.
And when somebody comes along and says, hey, I've got my freedom, they don't understand it.
See,
or they resent it, or they're jealous of it, or something.
Exactly.
I don't know what it is.
And now I have a lot of appreciation for the battle Christ was fighting with tradition.
Right.
What do you mean? My parents got the marriage license. Their parents got the... And it's really tradition that we're following and you know, not God's law. And marriage is a very interesting topic. And everyone's just so familiar with going ahead and getting that license.
Let's just take that. Explain. If you get a marriage license from the state, you don't need the state's permission to get married, okay,
that's
obviously.
Correct.
But if you decide to do that, that becomes a contract.
That's right.
Now, contractual law is very different than constitutional law.
That's right.
The Constitution gives us as people the right to make all the contracts we want.
That's right.
If I say, John, I'm going to pay you $1,000 an hour for the rest of my life, sign the contract. Of course, I'd be stupid to do that, but hey, if I signed the contract and didn't fulfill it, you take me to the local court, They find me guilty.
That's
they
right.
throw me in jail, take away all my property, and give it to you to pay the debt.
That's right.
And I can stand there all day long and say, I've got a constitutional right. Well, yes, you do, but I made the contract.
That's right.
And that's where I was a fool. That's what Proverbs 6 warns us about.
It's kind of interesting. You talk a lot about when people ask you, Ken, do you think we should be teaching creation in public schools? And I like the way you say, well, you're asking the wrong question. Let's talk about should we have public schools first, then the second question kind of takes care of itself.
That's the real question.
And what they're doing to us, they're giving us the same sucker punch. You know, they're setting us up, doing this, and then they're about to pop punches over here. And this thing about same-sex marriage comes up. And the real issue isn't same-sex marriage, right? Let's talk about the real question is, can the state sanction and create a marriage?
Any marriage?
No.
Same-sex otherwise. Yeah.
They can't. So once they've got the Christians to buy into this idea that it's the state that creates the marriage, that then, well, if they can create a marriage, now they can define the terms, whether it's male-male, female-female.
Sure.
And,
because we've already given them the right to make the decision. They don't have the right to make the decision.
That's right. So you know, and there's some other interesting things that happen. I know here in Florida there's language to this effect that says that the fruits of the marriage shall be deemed wards of the state. Okay? So if
you produce children.
You produce children, right? Now, if they are wards of the state, and they say, don't spank the state's children, it's a simple matter of contract, don't spank. Don't sit there and say, well, the Bible says that I have to. The matter is, what do you do with your children?
And you gave them to the state, so you made a contract.
Exactly.
Okay, suppose somebody did that. Somebody's watching this tape, and they say, hey, I did that. I got a marriage license, and I spanked my kid, and I'm in trouble. HRS or whoever's after me now. Are we getting ahead of ourselves? How to get out of that? How to undo the damage by making that contract? Or you want to cover that later, or is this a good time?
I think I had somebody call me about that last week.
Okay.
And their idea was, well, should we go and get a divorce now? Well, no, don't further validate the thing by getting a divorce. You know, because what are you saying? You're sitting there saying, well, we recognize that we had one of these marriages. Now we're trying to go and seek further, remedy from somebody that created damage already?
Right.
You know? I think the truth of the matter is was there ever a bona fide contract where all the terms and conditions were held on the table. And so I don't recommend doing things like trying to get a divorce and all this stuff.
Can you fill out papers, send them to take them to the courthouse, have them file stamped, that undoes your marriage license, at least undoes the contract with the state?
Well, what I like to do is go ahead and include that marriage license within our filing on our commercial affairs. So basically, that just like what we're going to be doing with the straw man, where we've been filing a UCC, one financing statement against the character down here, laying a claim by the real man against the straw man, every one of these quasi-contracts is going to be named within that UCC filing.
Okay, so they made 6, 8, 10, 20 contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these contracts, marriage license, social security number, driver's license, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you lay claim to those.
Right.
So then it doesn't matter. So now if the state says you can't spank your children, you say, excuse me, I own this contract. You don't own this contract anymore.
That's right.
So that's really the proper way to get out of this, isn't it?
It totally flips everything.
Okay.
And
does that work? I mean, in reality,
it has been working all over the country very well. And once the process is done right, it's been working very well. And ultimately, I know this, eventually we are going to get to the point where nothing works. And the powers to be are going to say this, bow down and worship the beast, the abomination of desolation.
Yeah.
And at that point, nothing is going to work, and it's either worship the beast or not. Now, I'm fairly pre-trib rapture in my thinking, and I don't believe the Christians are going to have to go through that period. I believe we will be raptured out of here before then. But inevitably, we are approaching a point when nothing is actually going to work.
You're going to have to stand for what's right, and it's going to cost you.
That's right. That's right. And ultimately, my opinion right now is I think in the last days there is going to be a great revival. But if you look at all the great revivals, and if you look at when the gospel of Christ was spreading, it was over the backs and deaths of the martyrs. And I think, you know, it kind of reminds me of the story of the two comrades standing on the corner. And the one guy said to his fellow comrade, "Comrade, if you had two houses, would you give me one?" Said, "Yes, comrade, I'm a good Communist Party member. If I had two houses, I would give you one." "Comrade, if you had two cars, would you give me one?" "Yes, comrade, I'm a good communist. If I had two cars, I would give you one." Okay. "Hey, comrade, one more question. If you had two shirts, would you give me one?" His comrade spit at him and walked away. "Well, why? What happened?" "I have two shirts."
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing in this country. For years, Christians have been saying, "Yes, I will die for Christ." But then they get ashamed to go to a restaurant and bow their head and let everybody see that they're praying. The guys at work, they're going to ridicule me. So God, so far, has not been asking us to die for Him. He's been asking us to live for Him.
And we're not even doing that.
And if we're ashamed to live for Him,
yeah.
And like Romans 12 says, you know, to bring...
Greetings. I'd like to invite you out to the Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th, 2013, located in Jacksonville, Florida. 3 days of executing and planning of executive plans for 25-year agenda, operating as an economic unit. The presenters will be Shem L. of the Temerang 2 Project, Dr. Ali Muhammad and Minister Inki of the Black Genetic Tour, Sundiata Amael, Professor Asa Deanham L, Tahaka Amana L, Abundance Child, Fatima, the Alchemist Shabazz, Messiah L, and more. Topics will be the execution of urban geoponics, creating independent distribution systems, creating independent economic systems, genetics, private security force, the wholesale and manufacturing of natural products, Morristown, creating one in every state, Morris Eastside Farms, putting one in every state. You do not want to miss this summit. It is very enlightening, empowering, and most of all, it's applicable. Everything that we talk about, we do. Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th. Log on to www.summitofthemoors.com. You can register for free. The summit is always free. You can also get your hotel room, which will be on the river at the Wyndham Hotel. That's www.summitofthemoors.com. The summits are always free. See you at the summit.
Okay, Moors, we're back. Now, back to the contracts. Now, if you notice, these guys were discussing the various words like license and registration and deed. And these are all contracts. And one thing they say have been working for people is the acceptance, back to offer and acceptance. Everything is an offer and acceptance inside the United States. But there are certain types of contracts. Even if you accept these contracts, you still have to eliminate these contracts, remove these things from you, get rid of them. And so we offer solutions to that right there at newfreehelpgroup.com. Tomorrow night, it's Wednesday night. I'll be dealing with more from Secrets of America with the Moorish American government. I'll be teaching there. So I would ask if you all would just dial into the national conference call tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. And the number to dial is 559-726-1200. That's 559-726-1200. The access code is 107985. Now, if you miss that broadcast and you want to go back and catch that broadcast, you dial 559-726-1299 instead of the 1200. It's 1299, and you go back and listen to previous shows right there at the Moorish American Government National Conference call, and that'll be 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow night on Wednesday nights. That's what we do there for all the Moors. We have a large Moorish audience that's listening, brothers and sisters from all over the United States listening to this broadcast tomorrow night. So make sure you tune into that, and then we'll be coming back Thursday evening with some more here, right here on Moorish Talk Live 100. So make sure you tune into that. Once again, for those who haven't received my free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play, and Secrets of America, go ahead and send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I will rush that right there to you. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll send you those free articles. One more time, August the 16th through the 18th, we'll be right here. You can come to the Moorish Summit right here in Wyndham Hotel, and it will be quite an event. We'll have Moors to come from all over the United States. You'll get a chance to meet your brothers and sisters here. I'll be here, and I look forward to seeing you when you get here. But now we're going to continue with this Redeeming the Straw Man so we can glean a little bit more of this information.
And ourselves a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable. If we're not even going to be willing to have our feelings hurt for Him, what would happen if the day came that we are asked to pay the ultimate and give our life for Him?
I see it as the frog in the pot analogy, where slowly raise the temperature. Christians keep saying, I'll never take the mark of the beast. Well, now, slow down. You already took the contracts. You already took the Social Security number.
Yes.
You already took all the licenses. You already took yourself out from under God's authority. Don't tell me you won't take the mark. You will take the mark. And I think we're going to be shocked at how many Christians can't succumb to the pressure when it reaches that point. Like, you know, they're heating up the furnace now.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's only going to be three that don't bow. That's what happened. You figure they took 7,000 Jewish young men captive, brought them to Babylon, trained them in the Babylonian language, Babylonian customs, and when he built that statue and said, bow down and worship it, 6,997 of those Jewish boys bowed down. They'd been taught all their life, don't bow to statues. Well, they did anyway.
Yep.
I mean, when you're looking at the furnace and looking at the statue, okay, you bow down and kiss the dirt. And I think this mark of the beast, when it says he causeth all to receive a mark in the right hand or the forehead,
mm-hmm.
and without the mark, you can't buy or sell. It's real easy for us to sit here and say, I'll never take that mark. Well, just wait till you're hungry.
Yes. Yeah, and that's exactly what happened in the Depression.
Sure.
You know?
Everybody's hungry.
Stand in line to take that mark.
And they create the crisis on purpose. The Depression was purposely created so that people would line up to take this number. And they're going to do another Depression or something so that people will line up to get the mark. Give me my chip. I want to go to the store and buy something. That's coming very soon.
Coming soon to a town near you.
Okay, here we are. We've gotten all these contracts, marriage license, driver's license, etc. Give us practical steps. Step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. What do you recommend average person do?
First of all, I think people really need to start studying and getting themselves up to speed.
Where do they get information?
On where they're at. And there's a whole series of good books that helps get you up to speed, you know. And a lot of times people say, John, are you talking conspiracy theories? And I say this, either you believe your Bible or not, and the Bible says there's a one world government coming, and there is going to be this thing called an abomination of desolation, right? Now, to me, that is the conspiracy, that
right.
Satan has been conspiring against God for all ages, and that is what everything is heading to. So Yes, I believe there's a conspiracy theory, and it's authored by Satan himself.
Yeah, Satan versus God. It's not a smoke-filled room someplace.
That's right.
Right.
So now there's a lot of books like The Federal Mafia, The Creature from Jekyll Island. There's a book you guys offer here at the ministry about World Without Cancer. All of that deals with cancer. Man, it is awesome to read that book and see how I.G. Fairbairn and Rockefellers and the DuPonts and just all these guys are together in this thing. And that is just a little taste of what happened with the medical industry. But what happened with the medical industry happened with law, happened with psychiatry, happened with even the churches, through this 501c3 thing. And it's amazing what happened. So, yeah, there's a lot of good books that people can get. And I say the first thing is, because we start talking about the straw man, there's a lot of things that happened to get up to the point where we are today.
Right.
And so there's a lot of these good books that I think that they can get and they can start reading. What I don't recommend that people, watch a tape like this and then say, I'm going to stop paying my taxes, and they have no idea what they're doing,
Get themselves in trouble. Go off half-cocked. Right.
And exactly. Because there's some people who that code obviously applies to. Right. And there's certain people that don't. I've got a friend that came over here from Germany. He doesn't file a tax return. All right? And obviously, he doesn't need to. But there's a lot of other people who don't need to file that return either.
Right.
And I'm not in a position to say whether you should be filing that return or not. You've got to look at your own scenario, look at the law, study the law, and make that determination for yourself.
Sure, and I've spent a long time studying that and trying to put this in perspective. Jesus said the love of money is the root of all evil.
That's correct.
And what we have here is some people who have a strong love of money, Rockefellers, etc., and who have worked to make us all their slaves.
Right.
You charge something on your credit card, they get 2 or 3%. They didn't do a thing.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. They're really raking in the dough.
They are.
They loan the money to the government so that they can collect the interest off of that loan. They'll even create a war. Country A fights Country B. We'll loan both of them money.
And we'll let them kill themselves.
Let them kill most of them. We've got to keep a few left to pay off this debt, because after all, they do all this money, Put a stop to the war when we're ready. Now you both start paying back this money. Because you don't recycle much on a $40,000 bomb.
Right.
You get 20 cents worth of scrap metal, So they make a fortune on it.
Right.
And so if we can keep in mind Jesus' words, the love of money is the root of all evil, and that Satan does indeed want to rule this world, and he hates humanity, then it starts to make sense of how we've got this problem.
Yeah.
We've allowed it to be created. Now, to redeem the straw man, to lay claim to this,
mm-hmm.
You help people do this.
Yes.
They say, first of all, they need to study and know what they're doing. Make sure they want to go this route.
Right.
What problems are associated? If I fill out the paperwork and follow your plan and say, send it off to the Secretary of State and say, I'm laying claim to Kent Hovind, the corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the pitfall? What do I have to be careful of?
Well, one of the beautiful things about doing this is a lot of people are very, or expecting that this total change in their life that's going to make everything instantly impossible for them. They're used to trying to get rid of that Social Security number and refuse mail that doesn't come addressed completely right. And the way I put it was a breath of fresh air to realize that I really don't have to change that much. I can go ahead and continue living my life as I'm living it and continue to utilize that Social Security number.
Okay,
I don't have to get rid of it.
They created a Social Security number. You just keep using it, you're saying?
I privatized it.
You privatized it?
Record it into my commercial affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go ahead and I keep using that. Because it's difficult, and you really got to know the law, and you really got to get an arm wrestle when you try and walk into a bank and get them to open a bank account for you without a Social Security number or EIN number. And a lot of
people won't do it because the bank is tied in with.
Well, a lot of people are shocked to find out that yes, you can do that.
Okay.
But the amount of effort that it takes, the normal person out there trying to work out a living for themselves doesn't have the time to go and investigate and research and study and study. And if I'm going to study, I'd rather be studying the Word of God than memorizing all of the legalism that Satan's been creating for the last 200 years. And so that's the thing I like about the system is you don't have to get rid of all these things, which is the traditional way a lot of people have been doing it, but you just lay claim to it and privatize it as yours, basically, is what you do.
So the bank that you go down and fill out the application to get a bank account and put that number on there, they don't realize that it's privatized, or do they care? Does it matter?
I don't think that little lady, as long as she gets a number from you, she's going to give you that bank account. So,
are you asking? Is that sticking your head in the noose for asking for trouble later?
I don't believe it is, no.
Because you have privatized it.
That's correct.
Okay, so if they study and find out, okay, yes, we're trapped, we've made ourselves a bed, we have to lay in it now. If you go in and say, I rescind my Social Security number, and some people do this, they're shocked to find out 20 years later the government did not rescind it.
Still there.
It's still there.
That's right.
Sure.
See, because what happened, the government used them as collateral and security to borrow money, and their blood, sweat, and tears was pledged to pay that loan back for the government.
Sure.
So that account was basically used to create money, all right? And they borrowed money against it. They can't just, you know, hit delete in their computer because now they got a big bookkeeping problem because they've already borrowed money against it.
Right. So if a person such as myself stop you.
Okay, Morgan, we'll be back to our next part, but we have a call on the line. Area code 910. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment. 910. Hello, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Hold on a second. All right, yeah, I hear you now.
All right, this is Darius calling out of Wilmington territory.
Okay, brother. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to know about the Mauritian Peace Treaty. Why did the Moors sign a treaty with the Europeans that was enslaving Africans?
You're talking about the Peace Treaty of 1786?
Yes.
Okay. That treaty was a treaty in commerce between the Emperor of Morocco and the Europeans. That didn't have anything to do with freeing you and me from anything. That was a treaty in commerce. The men who signed that treaty with the Emperor of Morocco were slave owners. See, one thing that we have to understand is that prior to the so-called African Holocaust, or the so-called African slave trade, which was nothing more than a Holocaust, there were Africans here on this landmass. And what happened was they wrote these Africans out, gave credit to other people, called them natives of the land, and just simply wrote you out of what's called a respectable commentary or history. But you're all over here. Your artifacts are all over here. Caves, temples, pyramids, all of this stuff is already here. Now, go ahead.
From my understanding, not only did they sign a treaty, they also gave them maps on how to capture us and help with the slave trade. And Islam pretty much nationalized slave trade, and the Europeans internationalized slave trade.
Well, I don't know about all that, but I do know that Morocco did sell Africans into slavery. But my point is that all people of African descent didn't come here for the first time on slave ships.
Yes, I know. We already navigated the whole earth.
Yeah. So
That's well-known knowledge now, and that's people need to understand that. But as far as the peace treaty of 1787, it didn't have anything to do with a treaty that gave us anything extra, anything. That was a treaty in commerce so that the wars between the Moors and Europeans would stop so that the Europeans could get here and establish themselves in this landmass. They didn't have anywhere else to go. They were running out of Europe, being thrown out too, to find somewhere to reside. And, of course, when they came here, they would do what they would always do, come in by force and killing and murdering and raping and pillaging. But that's how that went.
Okay, so I understand that. I was shocked when I came across that information. And Dr. Phil Valentine did a lecture on that. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with Dr. Phil.
Yeah, she did a lecture on that. He said it was Islam that started slavery. You know, they enslaved people, and the Europeans took that as, and, you know, took it and ran with it.
Well, I wouldn't doubt that. It's been a while since I've read the account of John G. Jackson, but I do know that the Africans asked the Islam to help remove Christianity from them and get the European Christianity out of Africa. And they agreed to do that, but then they turned around and re-enslaved them with Islam. We have to take a good look at all religions, and if we understand, ask the question, okay, regardless of what religion you have, let's take a look at religion, period. Let's get a clear and concise understanding of exactly what religion is. If it's Islam, if it's Christianity, if it's Buddhism, if it's Shintoism, I think it's a fair question to ask anyone to do the research and find out the origin, the people, places, times, and events that's attached to it so that we can know exactly what it is when it comes to religion or anything else. If you are a Christian, okay, tell me everything you know about Christianity. You believe in Jesus, okay, put your Bible down and tell me everything that you know about people, places, time, and events involving this particular character, okay?
Yeah, I mean, you really can't because it's all been fabricated. But I go to the essence of the things I was an ancient Kemet.
Okay. Yeah. So we deal with ancient Kemet. We deal with there are many ancient civilizations and things that occurred. But in order for what we are experiencing here in the United States to happen, they have to be a complete and total fabrication, a total degradation of a people. In order to maintain control of this type of thing and bury the truth, a complete burial of the truth, and the true people are the rightful owners of the land. Millions of dollars is invested in this fabrication and maintaining this lie, because once you tell a lie, you have to continue to prop that lie up. And invest in that lie to make sure that lie stays propped up. But the lie is falling down all over the country because the word is out.
Yeah, I mean, they picked the battle with the Creator, and they're not going to win.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I got another caller coming in, brother. You have another question?
That's it. I just wanted to see what your opinion was on the Mauritian Treaty.
Okay, then. Peace.
Thank you.
Erico 310.
Hey, this is Mwanzo from Irvine, California, and I just wanted to add, you know, this information that you first, I want to thank you for even broadcasting this information. A lot of people there are not aware of it. I became aware of it about maybe 3-4 years ago. I have over $1 million worth of education in my possession, and I just wanted to add to the discussion in reference to this game of commerce that was created in 1993, that what ended up happening was, I believe it was Roosevelt. When Roosevelt took the gold from everybody, he had committed treason. And so when he did that, he didn't know what he was doing. And so Congress had to come back a couple of days later. I think, believe it was June 3rd. And they came up with HJR 192. I haven't heard that brought up yet. So I just wanted to add that in there about HJR 192. If you need any proof for any of this stuff that's being discussed right now, HJR 192 basically states that since all money is gold and silver based on the Constitution, and since they took that away, that means that we will be all citizens, quote-unquote citizens, will be in perpetual debt, because you see the debt clock that they put up there on the news channels. We will always be in debt because they're killing off the dollar. And since that is the truth, then the federal government has, with HJR 192, has said that all of our debts will be prepaid, meaning that we have an unlimited amount of credit, which is the reason why the gentleman has spoke about being able to do bankruptcy after 7 years. I do it with traffic tickets. A traffic ticket, you know, what is crime? You know, crime is if you infringe on somebody else's rights or destroy their property. Well, when you're speeding, you aren't destroying anything. You're not committing a crime. So they have these statutes, which they call it an infraction. And what does the officer do? He forces you to contract. He forces you to contract by signing your name on that contract, saying that you're going to appear. Well, there's a certain way that you can cancel that contract based on the federal laws. I understand that they did talk about doing things on an international level with the UCC, but even on the federal level, it takes 72 hours after you sign a contract before the contract becomes legally binding. So what I do when I get my traffic tickets is you want to sign your ticket, you want to sign it either all rights reserved or without prejudice. This way, once you already have control of your straw man through UCC, what you do is you send that contract back within 72 hours, basically with a letter saying that you was forced to contract and you don't want to contract with their corporation, this and that, and everything has been absolved. I do this every time. I'm black, so I get a lot of tickets. I've had 4 charges against me. My car got towed. I had the registration, the insurance, no license, all of that. And basically what ended up happening for me was the ticket just disappeared. Because what you want to do is you want to send that letter to the officer and to the judge, whatever law administrative clerk that's going to be seeing your case. You want to send that to them within 72 hours of receiving that ticket. And you do not have to pay for these, quote-unquote, infractions. I just want to point out, HJR 192, that's the proof of the remedy. They don't have to tell us what our remedies are, but they do have to enforce them.
Okay. Well, let me ask you something now. You say that you write on that ticket your refusal to contract, and you mentioned
a
letter.
No. What I write on the contract or the ticket is without prejudice. I like to use that term because it's a legal term. If you do not own a Black's Law Dictionary, it is more important than your regular dictionary because you do not understand the true meaning of the words of the English language unless you read this Black's Law Dictionary. All law is contract law. But basically, without prejudice is a term that means you are reserving all of your rights. The reason why you want to reserve all your rights, just like at the end of a movie you say all rights reserved or with your trademark, is because when you write that letter to the judge and to the officer, you want them to understand that you are not giving up any of your rights based on the Constitution. Now, the Constitution, like he was saying, the Constitution protects you, the human flesh being. A lot of people, I know I grew up not understanding, like, man, they teach us the Constitution, but they violate it all the time. The reason why is because they created these corporations that don't have any rights, and they make you give up your rights. They make you there's so many little tricks that they have, but what I sign on there is I sign without prejudice, and then I sign my name. That's what I put on there. A lot of times the officers, they don't pay attention. You can sign it under duress as well, but it's more important, it's more powerful if you put without prejudice or all rights reserved. And basically what that does is that when they go back and look at that contract, when you send it back to them, you know, the power is in the pen, you know, just like they were saying about the way how money is created is through our signature. Money is created through our signatures because of the credit, the unlimited credit that we have. And so when you sign that and you send that letter in with that contract that they force you to sign, they have no reason. I mean, I actually went in. There was one time I was in a city, Inglewood, out here in California. That's where I had got my car impounded, and I had like four charges against me. And it wasn't that I didn't have it. It's just that they wouldn't allow me to give it to them. Well, I ended up going. I didn't show up to my court date because I wanted to do something else. But I went down to the courthouse to, you know, follow up on the ticket. And they told me, they looked in the system and they was like, this ain't even here. And I'm like, are you sure? Now, usually I wouldn't have questioned, but this was when I was first testing things out for myself. And I had a copy of the ticket on me. I was like, are you sure? And I gave the clerk the copy of the ticket. She seen it. She was like, nah, this isn't in here. Now, I don't know what ended up happening to it. I just know that it disappeared. I know that I don't have no warrant. I know that I didn't have to pay anything, because that's another thing. Even if the officer makes a mistake, you still, even if you prove that they made a mistake and they did something wrong, you still have to pay this administration fee. $25 or something like that. I just learned today that even when you are fighting your tickets, this is something else that people need to know. When you're fighting your tickets and you want to plead not guilty, a lot of people, they just go and say no contest because they don't want to have to deal with it because they can't pay the bail money, quote-unquote bail money, so that they can fight their ticket. Well, all you have to do is ask for you to be released on OR. You do not have to put up any bail money, and all you have to do is ask the judge, say, well, can you show me in writing, in order to show me the law where I have to pay some money? I mean, we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. Why do I have to pay money? You guys are bringing this against me. But what you can do, something very simple, is basically request to be released on OR. You do not have to pay any of the money, and especially if you will be able to win your case, you don't have to come out the pocket for that. I mean, basically, courts are just banks. All they do is take money.
Let me ask you this. What about the letter that you say went along with the ticket that you without prejudice on? What type of letter did you use?
All right, I have a letter. I'm connected with you on Facebook. I can send you a copy of it. It was basically, I got this letter, okay, I got this letter from a gentleman who had put it together some years back, and basically in the letter, it has the date, the time of the stop or the pullover or whatever. You have the officer's name and their badge number. You have your information. Now, in order for it to be effective, I mean, you can do it without having a UCC filing, but if they end up wanting to do some research, you do want to make sure that that's in place. I have a letter that basically is stating you don't want to contract with the officer, because that's what the officer is doing. They're contracting with you. They're already claiming you guilty. They're charging you. They are an officer of the court. Actually, that is your first arraignment. The reason why is because
the letter you got, the letter you using, is in an affidavit
I don't use no affidavit. I do send it certified mail to make sure that I have proof of that. You can send it and get it notarized, because I don't know if you know, but anything that you do on the private side cannot be it can be entered as evidence on the public side, and they can't do anything on the public side to refute your private evidence. So I mean, I don't go as far as to getting it notarized or doing an affidavit. I send just a regular letter, like, hey, look, you know, and then I have my proof of my UCC, and I have the fee of the ticket and my letter, and I send that, and that's it. Send a copy to the officer, and I send one to the whoever is the presiding judge.
Mm-hmm. It was all about opting out the contract.
Yes, opting out the contract. I mean, there's other different things that you can do if you want to go into court and play their little game, but the number one thing is you want to stay out of the court. It's not set up for you to win. It's not for you. So the best thing for you to do is to stay out of there. There are some things that you can do. You know, something simple is basically asking the judge, who does the judge work for? Because you have a right to a fair trial, right? You have a right to a fair trial. And who does the judge work for? The judge works for the state. And who is the state? The state is the plaintiff that's bringing charges against you. So that's not a fair trial. So that's another easy, quick way to just they don't like it. You know, a lot of times when I was appearing in court, I do everything by mail now, but when I was appearing in court, what they would do is they don't want everybody else that's coming in there like cattle to be seen, to see what's going on. And so when they recognize what's going on, then they'll push me off to the side, get everybody else out the courtroom, then they bring me back up, and then, you know, we have whatever exchange that we have in the courtroom.
Okay. All right. Well, you got anything else that we need to know about?
Man, I got over $1 million worth of information, and your show not that long, but I am moving to Jacksonville within a couple of weeks. I would like to hook up with you and connect with you and share some of the information that I have. I know that I could benefit from some of the information that you have, and, you know, I just look forward to connecting with you in a couple of weeks or so. I will definitely be down there for the Moorish little event that's going to be there.
Okay. All right. Well, we look forward to having you down, and I appreciate you calling in and giving us this information. And what you have told us this evening is the same thing that I've been preaching on this broadcast for a long time. There are a lot of new people here on the broadcast that's unaware of it, but a lot of us tune in all the time. They know exactly what you're talking about because they've already heard it before. But I certainly appreciate you, man, and I look forward to seeing you when you get here.
Definitely.
All right, bro. All right. Now, Moore, we're going to deal with this last segment, and then if you got any more questions and comments after that, we only have a few moments left. Y'all go ahead and raise your hand.
Security number 25, 30 years ago. Okay, didn't use it for anything. I went down to the Social Security office and said, "Can you look up this number for me, please? My number from 30 years ago."
Mm-hmm.
"Sure, no problem. Here's your name." I said, "How much have I paid in?" And I had paid in for several years, and all of a sudden there's 0000000 for many, many years, but
right.
I'm still in there.
Yes.
I filled out the paperwork when I got ordained. That mm-hmm. They said, "You fill out these papers, you can drop out of Social Security." I did all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? They still have me.
Yes.
So the options are try to fight that the rest of your life, or accept it, ask for a new card, which has the new a number on the back. It's very interesting. That's your account number at the bank, right? At the,
right.
At
yes.
the Federal Reserve Bank.
That's
so,
right.
So get a new card after 92. Then if you use that, you go through the steps of filing certain papers to privatize that, to redeem this straw man. And really, nothing changes much in your lifestyle, but you now are back up here as a free man.
Right.
Under God's authority.
You know, it's kind of like when somebody accepts Christ as their Savior. You know, what changes? You know, well, you don't have to do anything. There's an internal change that happens.
Right.
And it's the freedom that you experience is overwhelming.
Right.
And it, by accepting Christ, it does not put you under a great big long list of laws and do's and don'ts. It's total.
People think it does, though. It's tragic.
Total freedom.
I see Christians that they think, people are like, well, if I become a Christian, I got this big long list.
You know, the way I see it, Christianity is kind of like being on railroad tracks. Okay? And a lot of times words are deceptive.
Right.
You know? Sometimes the most restricting thing in the world is free will. Because once you exercise that free will, that choice has just locked out every other possibility and has put you on a specific track or a specific mm-hmm. path. And if we have two trains, one's not on railroad tracks, see how far it's going to go.
Sure.
And another's on railroad tracks. You know, it's like there's a lot of freedom within the confines of marriage.
Stay on the track. You go a lot faster than you will trying to go on the gravel.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. Okay, so we've made all these contracts, marriage license, driver's license, etc. We just simply privatize them. They belong to me now.
That's right.
And so the government says you have to renew this driver's license. Send us $50, please, or something. What do you do?
If you wanted to, you could go down and renew that, or you could use a commercial process on that.
And is that would take hours and hours to explain a commercial process?
Yeah, it probably would.
Okay.
Get into it, and we'd talk another couple hours probably.
Because basically, when they created this straw man, they mm-hmm. created an account, and you could direct them to pay that straw man's bills.
That's right.
Out of that account.
That's right.
Now, you can't go get all that money and say, send it to me, please, you know, but you can, let's say they want $50 for a driver's license to renew it. You could direct the Secretary of the Treasury to pay that $50.
Out of your DTA.
Out of your DTA. Designated
direct Treasury account.
Direct Treasury account. Okay, I know we're going to get 1,000 phone calls, and that's what I don't want if people see this tape. I don't want to hear any more about it because I don't know any more about it, okay? there are people that will help. Right Way Law.
Right Way Law.
Helps people.
Jack Smith and the guys out there at Right Way Law.
They've been studying the law for years, and they encourage people, look, study the law, obey the law. I think everybody should obey the law, even the government.
Even the government.
Even the government, sure. I'm not trying to break the law. So if you want to get a bank loan, no problem. You just go down and they have
fill out the paperwork.
Fill out the paperwork.
And get a loan. I just have problems with a Christian going down and getting loans.
Yeah, we should try that. Oh, no, man, anything.
That's right.
But some people, the reason a lot of churches don't want to get unincorporated is because if they get unincorporated, they feel they can no longer give out tax receipts for their members who give money,
right.
Which goes back to what Jesus said, the love of money is the root of all evil. The fact of the matter is you can give out a tax receipt if you want.
That's right. You know, I think
I give out receipts to people. If they donate to our ministry, we can give them a receipt.
Yes.
I'm not a 501c3 corporation. We give them receipts all day long. You know,
that's
no
right.
Problem.
I think the other thing people need to do, they need to start reading some of the foundational law that set the country up. They need to go, and most people don't even know, how do I get a copy of my state constitution? You mean my state even has a constitution?
Right.
They don't even know that. And you read the state constitutions, and most of the state constitutions I've seen, churches are exempt from taxes.
Right.
They don't have to file. It's just a matter in their constitution that they can't tax the church. So there's a lot of misconceptions people have, and those misconceptions are basically, you know, what Christ was even fighting, tradition. You know, it's a misconception for such a long period of time that it now becomes tradition and everybody does it. Well, because everyone's done it. Everyone
sure.
has always done it. So we need to start looking and reading some of the foundational documents.
All right. Well, we'll add more to this tape from time to time. We want to encourage you to don't get distracted on things of this world that are not going to matter anyway. I think we should try very hard to keep ourselves directly accountable to God. But I see an awful lot of Christians get distracted, wasting hours and hours and hours on what some people call the Patriot Movement, whatever that is. You know, I don't know what it is. But, you know, spend thousands of hours on things that they're not going to matter 5 seconds after you're dead anyway.
Right.
You know, let's go win souls and, you know,
Amen.
Preach the gospel. But the concept of redeeming the straw man has been fascinating to me as I listened through the tape seminar while I was driving. I listened to the audio tapes from Right Way Law. And it was interesting that we have really let them take us into captivity. And it's not that hard to redeem yourself.
That's right.
To get out of that.
It's easy.
So there's another factor, though, that I think some people miss. Because I'm not under the law here, I could drive 100 miles an hour, 200 miles an hour on the interstate if I wanted, as long as I don't hurt anybody, according to my constitution.
Right.
I cannot be deprived of my property without due process, and that has to have been an injured party. If I don't wear a seatbelt, I didn't injure anybody.
That's right.
The state can require their person to wear a seatbelt because that belongs to them, and they're concerned about him.
Right.
But if I've redeemed him,
It's interesting because in Florida, the speed statute that cops love to write is 316.183. And if you get a ticket, I can almost guarantee you that's a statute they're going to write on lawful speed. And if you know how to follow that law through, you look at the statute, and at the bottom of the statute gives history and things like that. And then there is something called the administrative code.
Right.
And a lot of people don't even know there's the administrative code, and they don't know how it's the administrative code going hand in hand with the statute that has the force and effect of law. And they don't know how to look all that stuff up. But you go through to you're implementing regulations, and 316.183 was enacted so that the state could regulate its school bus drivers.
Doesn't have to do with the average driver anyway, does it?
Has nothing to do with the average driver. The helmet law. The state would like its troopers, when they're out driving around on their Harleys, to make sure they have helmets on. That makes a lot of sense. I used to have a sign business, and I told guys when they used the saw, they had to have safety glasses. Well, when they punched out at the end of the day, went home and used their saw, if they wanted to wear safety glasses, they did.
Sure.
You know, my company policy did not apply to them at home.
Uh-huh.
So what they try and do, the state comes and passes policy for its highway troopers, and they want everyone to follow it when that law doesn't apply to everyone.
Sure.
It doesn't have that authority.
Well, the other factor, let's take seatbelt. Okay, I've redeemed my straw man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to wear my seatbelt if I don't want to. Number one, it's smart to wear your seatbelt.
Amen.
Number two, I don't want my liberty to be a stumbling block to others.
That's right.
Yes, I can drive 200 miles an hour as long as I don't hurt anybody.
And if you were out
That's a bad testimony.
If you were out in Nevada in the desert, there's no one around, maybe if you wanted to, right? But I don't believe as a Christian I can go 200 miles an hour through town or out on I-75.
I don't believe my old man will do 200 miles an hour anyway, but
the spirit won't let me. So it's, you know, and the other thing, I think what a lot of people need to do is they need to go down to the courts. Find out when they're having criminal traffic proceedings, right? Guys driving on suspended license, drunk driving, things like that. And you're going to find out that there's so many.
Okay, Morris, we're going to come back at a later date and deal with part two of this thing. And but I certainly appreciate all you all for tuning in, and I hope you got something out of it. Don't forget tomorrow night on the Morris American National Conference call, we'll be discussing the second phase of secrets in America, and we'll be dealing with how this thing is set up, all the intricate details and nuts and bolts and wiggle pins of that. And we've given the number for you to call into the National Conference call. And those of you who might have missed it, it's 559-726-1200. And the access code number is 107-985 and press the pound key. Now, if you missed the broadcast and you want to dial in at a later date and listen to what you missed, call 559-726-1299. And, of course, the same access code. And you can listen to the broadcast. We will be there tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we will be discussing contract law and within the confines of the secrets inside of America. So make sure you are there
to hear this broadcast. I've been your host, Tahako Mana L. Bay, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time.
Thank you.